Now, when Jesus, sorry, this is from Matthew 19, verse 1 to 15. Now, when Jesus had finished these sayings, he went away from Galilee and entered the region of Judea beyond the Jordan. And large crowds followed him, and he healed them there. And Pharisees came up to him and tested him by saying, "Is it lawful to divorce one's wife for any cause?" He answered, "Have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female, and said, 'Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh.' So they are no longer two, but one flesh. And therefore God has joined what God has joined together, let not man separate." They said to him, "Why then did Moses command one to give a certificate of divorce and to send her away?" He said to them, "Because of your hardness of heart, Moses allowed you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery." The disciple said to him, "If such is the case of man with his wife, it is better not to marry." But he said to them, "Not everyone can receive this saying, but only those to whom it is given. For there are eunuchs who have been so from birth, and there are eunuchs who have been made eunuchs by men, and there are eunuchs who have made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. Let the one who is able to receive this receive it." Then children were brought to him, that he might lay his hands on them and pray. The disciples rebuked the people, but Jesus said, "Let the little children come to me, and do not hinder them, for to such belong the kingdom of heaven." And he laid his hands upon them and went away. The Lord.
Things, he left Galilee and went to the region of Judea to the other side of the Jordan. Large crowds followed him and he healed them. So begins the reading for today. Every year, as many of you know, we spend 1 year from basically the new year until Easter season in one gospel. This year is Matthew's gospel. And many of you know also that there's this overarching schedule of readings called the lectionary, which is used by Catholics, many different Protestant groups, this, that, and the other, that prescribe readings for certain days to be read. In Matthew's year, which is year A, all the readings are from John, which doesn't help us. And so I went to year B to see, because Mark's short, and almost all the readings were from John. So I was like, well, maybe year C, you know, Luke and Matthew overlap a lot in content, and almost all the readings were from John. And I was like, they seem to be telling us something in the way in which they're selecting the readings. But then I noticed, not all of them, most of them, none of them were from Matthew for the most part, but I noticed a lot of them were these conflicts, where sort of this opposition to what Christ has taught in the first half of these Gospels is then sort of met with Pharisees, scribes, obviously in the end, the Roman government and this sort of thing, different sort of conflicts as he goes so that he is pressed in these ways. And so it's like, okay, so I'll read forward from where we are and look for where there's a conflict and pick that one. And so I got to Matthew 19 and I was like, no, not that one. Because we don't talk about marriage and divorce and all these things all that much, or even this ideal that Christ paints back to Genesis 2, that man and woman were in the garden and they become one flesh. And so then, because you have to do like some introspection in life, not too much, you don't want to go crazy. But because my initial response was no, then I was like, okay, I have to do that one. Because it's a word that is good for us. It's a word that's healing for us. This teaching, a large crowd followed him and he healed them there. Frederick Dale Bruner, in his commentary on Matthew, says Matthew obviously means physical healings at this moment in Jesus' ministry. But he said if we look at what Jesus teaches in these next several blocks, they've brought therapeutic healing to so many people. They've sort of healed in that way. And so I figure it's for us to hear this, to watch how the Pharisees pick this particular instance to test him on and why that is. What Jesus goes back to and how he sort of appeals in that place. And then the eunuch one, which is not, we don't talk about marriage and divorce a lot in the church, or at least this church. We certainly don't talk about eunuchs at all. But there's an interesting teaching in there. And then I don't have as much to say about that final blessing with the children, other than it's so beautiful that Christ sort of takes that time to sort of, his disciples were wrong about marriage, they were wrong about children, that in this teaching about becoming one flesh, about those who don't have, if you want to hear instead of eunuchs, which I want to hear instead of eunuchs, celibate for various reasons, can't have children, we find our single, sexless Savior blessing children, not his own children, but children that are brought to him. And I think all that makes sort of this beautiful whole in this passage of sort of ordering the household of God. You know, what is this first one, this union that creates these children? What is this honor that he has for celibacy and singleness? And then what is this honor he has for the least of these children? So that's sort of the shape of the passage for today. But before we really get started, the first, and I told Emily, could you throw this in the intro? And she said, no, it's up to you. Was one of the values at Defiance Church, actually I think in our constitution, is that we practice generous orthodoxy. And so the idea is we have generosity in a wide variance of beliefs on these things. So if you don't agree or have some qualms with what I was saying today, first off, congratulations, welcome to church, we all have that. But second off, I'm not imposing anything from above, but trying to work and listen to the spirit of the text as best as I can. There are pastors who say, you know, I get attacked from the right in my congregation, I get attacked from the left in my congregation, so that means I'm right. And I always want to say, or you could be wrong twice. So whatever I say, you know, there are people to the left of me, there are people right to me, and I'm fully aware that I could be wrong twice. So that's a possibility. The second is that and so the church is full of disagreements. I'm aware that no church is of one mind on this. It was one of the reasons why we moved from our previous denomination to our current one. I was talking to the head bishop at that time, and he said to me, Matthew, is your church of all one mind on this issue? And I said, no, I don't think any church is. He said, that's good to hear, because we're aware of that. And I was like, I thought he was quizzing me to be like, are we pure enough to be a part of this? And he was like, it is so good that you're aware that this is not. We live in a fractured time like that. And so nobody has to believe all of what this vertical thing believes, but we go forward in grace. And the last thing is that we go forward in the grace of, Emily used the phrase that Jesus is going to use for the Pharisees and why there were an opening up as hardness of heart. But there's a way of hearing that hardness with heart is as a God who has grace with us when we're not where we could be. That God didn't look at the Israelites and say, this is going to be a land of marriages that are either so broken because they're not meant to be together, or that these people are so stiff-necked that they are just going to be apart forever, I'm going to allow it. Whatever it was, God, through Moses' teaching in that passage, allowed for humanness to exist. He didn't come down from on high and say, perfect it or nothing. And so as I go through this teaching, I hope nobody hears perfect it or nothing, or even some sort of judgment that comes from anywhere other than hearing what Jesus says. I mean, if you're like, oh, well, the way you said it, I'm like, well, ignore that. You have to hear what Christ says in these passages. And I think it's useful or worth considering for our Lenten journey that we live in a context in a world that is so fraught with difficulties around these teachings. It's one thing to say, look, church, sort yourself out. But we live in a very fractured world. You don't see as much, I mean, I don't watch all the TV, but you don't see as much healthy relationships proposed or novels written from healthy places or this, that, and the other. We almost have more of an interest in the alternative than the normative. And that says a lot about our world and how we can fall into that, is this deep interest in everything alternative, so that we forget about the normative. And in some sense, for us, the alternative becomes better than the normative. The question about what to do about, I think the church has a mass amount of disagreements about what to do about the exceptions to the rule. And I think that's something that churches have to wade through. What do we do about the exceptions to these things? These heavy questions about people who don't fit into this exact box. Or, I mean, even divorce and remarriage, to LGBTQ concerns, all that, this sort of exception. But for the church to have the stance of saying, like, we have received from Jesus this sort of instruction from the creative order that is at least our centered spot. And then from there, we can look off to what do we do about the other places. And again, I'm under no delusions that we'll all agree. But I do think it's worth then spending that time with what is design. And then from there, we can talk about, we won't, but you could talk about what do we do with the things that don't fit into that design. All this is just me asking for lots of grace. Don't get mad at me. But it's my first joke. The Pharisees came to test him, and they asked him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason and any and every reason? That's the first teaching here, and I just love this, because when you apply for a pastoring job today, that's instantly the first question you're going to get asked, too, is about marriage. So Jesus gets asked, what do you think of marriage, at his first sort of test here? And so if you're a pastor or a Christian even today, most of the time people will be like, oh, it's great, you're a Christian. What do you think about this issue? And that's sort of the way in which things have gone ever since then, which I just find, maybe that's an inside joke. I just think that's funny, is that, like, we're still caught in this same conundrum of what do you think of this thing? And in a moment of awareness and confession, one of the commentators calls the Pharisees the serious, and he puts in his translation, is it biblical? Which I just think that might ring a little bit more true for you when these questions come up. Is it biblical or is it orthodox? And the way that Jesus answers is interesting. But to say that, like, if you've developed in life, there was a time in my life where a woman who, I was her RA, her freshman year of college, she went to Spain, she came back, and she said, I'm a Christian. And I was like, I knew you as somebody who hooked up with a lot of people and hookup culture ways and did a lot of drugs. And so I wanted to know, like, how did this work out? And she said, well, in Spain, the only thing that was in English on TV was Joyce Meyer. And it was healing balm for me, which, so now I have more questions. And yet, I mean, in the end, I think how wrong I was in coming to the questions I came to in the way of sort of like thinking through those things, like instead of rejoicing first off, which would have been the appropriate reaction, I was more like, say more. And then trying to sort out ethical conundrums and what she believed about this. And have you thought about MTV's Spring Break lately? And how is that a picture of human flourishing or not? That we exist in this same sort of conundrum. I mean, if maybe it's just me and I had that phase in my life, but some of you might be able to remember a time in your life. And it happens from both sides of the spectrum. I don't think one side of the spectrum has greater ownership of this, but certainly at that moment I was more like, I'm in a college ministry. Of course I'm a nerd, and these are the questions I'm going to ask you about how you understand your Christianity. But almost all of them didn't really point to the heart of things. And I could have used much more humility and interest and celebration at that moment in my life than sort of like, well, how are you on this ethical survey of things that at least me and my 21 years of knowledge have become to decide are very important in the midst of college. Maybe nobody else can relate to that, but I do feel like there's this way in which we can come and say, here you are, I want to test you on moral qualms and figure out if you're on my side or not. The Pharisees, I think, certainly are trying to figure out if Jesus is on their side or not, but more than that, I think trying to trap him in this sense, that the Pharisees came to test him. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? And now, to the text a little bit, less about me, more about this, is this question, for any and every reason. The Deuteronomy teaching about divorce is interesting on sort of what's phrased in there, but the rabbis at Jesus' time had two different ways of interpreting it. One was sort of grave illness or challenge or this, that, and the other, something that disrupted the relationship, infidelity, those type of things, more normal to what we think. The rabbis, the Pharisees, some of them seem to be asking, and was practiced at the time, like any reason. So one famous rabbi, Rabbi Hillel, was burnt food was a legitimate reason to divorce your wife. And Rabbi Akiba, who helped us out in the Song of Songs, said a more attractive woman was a legitimate reason to divorce your wife. We laugh. I don't know if things have changed as much as we think they have, but they... Yeah, those were two legitimate reasons. And so they're inviting Jesus sort of into this inner conflict within Judaism, which we don't quite see because we're reading it from 2,000 years later. But are you going to take the sides of people who say divorce only for like serious issues, moral faults, this, that, and the other, or divorce for any reason whatsoever, which seems to be the side that they're leaning on? And based on the way Jesus answers, they're going to be able to play off what he thinks of Deuteronomy and how he's relating to the law. Now, there's another way of looking at this. Jesus already did address divorce in the Sermon on the Mount, and so it might be that as they've finally grown in this awareness that this guy is going to be a problem for us, they're trying to trap him on, like, we know he said this before, let's get him to say this now as he's making his way to Jerusalem so that we can be one to say with us, he's not in our tradition, he's not one of us, he's not this. The amazing part about this is they are asking a legal question, and Jesus replies with this question of order and design. He doesn't reply in the legal sense. And so we have two values at Defiance Church. One is tradition and one is order. We have three others, but tradition and order, and tradition is what we've received, and order is sort of this way in which we try to live into the way in which God has designed and how we live fractured and apart from that. Jesus, in this instance, is first being invited into the task of traditioning. The task of traditioning is saying, did it mean this? Did it not mean this? Does it weighted like this? How do you understand this teaching within a complex teaching? So he's being invited in the sense of traditioning, but Jesus, unlike, I think, my temptation, doesn't fall to tradition, and tradition might have been any reason, whatever reason, but he falls to the direction of order. He doesn't go with, let's work this out. Hillel said this, Akiba said this, you guys say this, let's wait it all out and figure out what's this, that, and the other. But he goes, haven't you read, which I just, if anybody asks you, is it biblical? Then always reply with, haven't you read, and some Bible quote, because that'll really get them on your side. It'll make friends real fast, especially if it's Genesis. Like if you're like, haven't you read in Malachi? They're like, that's a tough one. Haven't you read in the book of Genesis? They're like, yeah, we've all like, first three chapters we read over and over and over again. That's when the Bible and your plan ends. Haven't you read that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female? For this reason said, a man will leave his father and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh, and so that they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate. Here Jesus appeals to that pre-fall state, which is, I think, worth weighing in our considerations of how we live forward with this, because Jesus is saying, let's look at it was like before the fracturing of a human existence happened. So if you don't think this means go forward with grace on this teaching, then you're kind of siding with like, let's pretend like the fall never happened. But Jesus is saying, if we're going to think through this sort of correctly and wisely, let's not ask this exception, this thing, have you thought about this, this, that, and the other, but what its original design was, where it started, what it would be if there was no fracture in the human condition. Which it cracks me up that like nobody ever comes up to a pastor or anyone and says, look, my Aunt Bob and Aunt Judy have been faithfully married for 60 years. They love each other. They've been through trials. It's been beautiful. What do you think about that? it's always with something they want to prove or this, that, and the other. It's pastors at weddings. My first pastor I worked with told me, like, you're like everybody's pastor at the wedding, and they all want you to come and like adjudicate something that's ever happened to them in life. And I was like, that can't be true. It's true. But they never come with like, this is a beautiful thing. What do you think of this beautiful thing? It's always like, here's something that I've been slighted on. Can you help me prove that I'm right? Which is always fun, because you never really know quite what to say. But Jesus goes back to the beginning, pre the fall here. Now, there's a teaching here that I think is very interesting in that second creation story. The first creation story has its own narrative, the second. And when I say first and second, I think that they're more, there's different things going on. I don't think there are two creation stories, but the first one is Genesis 1, the second one is Genesis 2. They have massive similarities, but they have some dissimilarities that make the question raise of they're telling us two different things. But in the second one, there's this idea that Adam is one person, and Eve is taken from his side, as my daughter read. And then they're two people, and they become one flesh. And rabbis have taken that to mean that the original Adam was sort of like one being, the balance of male and female in some sense. And when he's taken apart, the second person becomes half of what the first person was. And so that when they come together in marital union, they become that one flesh again. That one thing. There's mysticism and all sorts of weird stuff wrapped up in this, but it does make sense to me in some sense to say that there's that union. And in the church, the Catholic Church that has thought about this more than the Protestant Church, often sees Christ as living that perfect union of restoring, because he doesn't have a partner, but he's fully human. So he becomes that one who lives that union that was before Adam lost his rib in some sense. But it raises that question of what does he mean by one flesh again? There's commentators who were very much more interested in that he becomes a third thing, that a third thing is invented from the male and female union, like one plus one equals this third thing. But I was thinking of, I think it's more interesting to think about as the healing of that fracture, that together we become that one thing which bared the image of God again, that we become whole in that way. And that heightens up, I guess, what happens and what does it mean to become one flesh. The church history has said man was not intended to be alone, so God didn't create one human, and man was not intended to be polygamous, so God didn't create two men and two women either. Like, but to sort of heal this divide that happens in our nature. Tim Keller, in his book on marriage, the most controversial chapter, which is about sort of how of ordering a marriage. And it is controversial, but he takes this concept from Mirzal Wolf, is that a marriage is embracing the other. Marriage is embracing the other. If male and female sort of come apart at this moment, then what we do in marriage is embrace that other half that is other than us. Now, what that otherness is, I'd like to keep my job and not have anybody be mad at me, so I'm not going to get into that. But I think there's lots of ways that gets filled in, but just to say that like we embrace that other, which is not exactly like this. This was a book in the 90s, Men Are from Mars and Women Are from Venus, that there's something there, and that the marriage embrace is that embrace of that other that makes that one thing again, or to cleave to one another. And this is this first creation of this new union, and it's a very serious union. I've used this story before, this creation of this new thing and how it is guarded and structured and made. My professor in seminary, Dan Allender, who I still think is insane, was asked by one of his kids, if mom and I fell out of the boat, who would you rescue first? And he says to his daughter, he's a psychologist and he thinks he knows what she's asking, that I would rescue your mother first. She's like, oh, okay, I get that. He was like, no, hang on. I would rescue your mother first. I would dry her off. I would get her some food. I would make sure she was hydrated. I would hand her a towel. I would do all these things. And then I would look for you. His daughter is very sad at this point. She's crushing dreams left and right, as Dan Allen Eller sings. But she comes to him 2 weeks later, and she says, I was glad that you answered that way. That union that she witnesses isn't usurped by the children. I've counseled people in marriages that say, regardless of what you think, regardless of what I feel and say about my spouse, I love my children so much And when I hear that, I challenge them. I go, okay, what would it take for you to equal the love for your children? I'm not reaching for the stars here. Not make it higher, but equal the love you have for your children to have for your spouse. Like, what steps could you make so that, they're at least even? Because you say that, and it sounds like, see how good I am. But I think a lot of us, if you sit with that notion for a little bit, that sounds kind of terrible. Like the partner they created this one with, the one in whom they're sharing this, the one in which they are mom and dad with this child with, they're bragging that the product of that union or the gift of that union is higher than the union itself. And it's not entirely lost on me that many of those parents I've sat with in those situations are often the most manipulative of their children, because they have no other valve to which their children can be children. Their children almost become pseudo-spouses in that sense, because it's gotten out of order. And that is a deep, deep challenge in our world. Who do you love more? I think it was Dan who said that when you forsake all others in your marriage vows, it's the murder of all other people. That you sort of embrace this one as this thing. It's the forsaking of all others is the murder of all other. Jesus, because it sort of ends this teaching, therefore what God has joined together, let no one separate. In more accurate in the Greek would be, now stop tearing it apart, is what he's telling the Pharisees. Now in your extreme sort of liberty, liberalism in interpreting this passage as anything's fine, now stop tearing what God has joined together apart. This quote on the back of the bulletin is somewhere up here. We all come from divorce. This is an age of divorce. Things that belong together have been taken apart, and you can't put it all back together again. What you can do is the only thing you can do is you can take two things that ought to be together, and you ought to put them together again. Two things, not all things. This is Wendell Berry, and I've shared this quote before. But as we're thinking about this passage and Jesus is going back to order and why order is one of our values, this isn't the only thing that's falling apart in the world. Marriage is not the only thing that has been ripped in some ways. We exist, as he says, in an age of divorce. So many things that are meant to be together, we've pulled apart. And there are ways in which we think the remedy is then, let's put it all back together. Barry, I think, knows that you would do more damage if you quickly tried to remedy all the things. And so if you're fortunate or in the midst of this and you know, and you're like, I'm not divorced, what can I take from this teaching? Is I think that what God orders in that created state, in that pre-fall state, has been defamed and destructed throughout the world in so many different ways. Marriage being one instance, but so many others. And so it's for all of us that we come from this age of divorce, of this age of it all falling apart. I have a lot more to say, but I'm going to move forward because that's probably God's wisdom for my life. That's the Deuteronomy teaching. We'll skip that. That's Malachi. God hates divorces in that passage, so I'm in the right spot. No, I was one off. So why then did Moses command the man give his wife a certificate of divorce and to send him away? They think they sort of have their trump card here. Is why Moses on our side, why did Moses demand this? Jesus replied, Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard. Going back to that earlier teaching I sort of mentioned is that God works with us where we are. In the post-fall state, your hearts were hard, but it was not that way from the beginning. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another woman, commits adultery. I want to move forward, but just to say that abuse, the church has done much better on, the world has done much better on, leaving people destitute, emotional abuse, physical abuse, all this, like, if Jesus is, I think, within sexual morality here, which I think the Greek word is porneia, which is sort of this violence thing, all of those are appropriate reasons for people to move on in divorce. I think I just want The church has gotten in trouble for not being clear on this, so I just want to be clear that there are fractures in the unions of that people have that end the thing because they're no longer human. They're no longer designed for what God has. And essentially that rupture that happens in sexual morality is one of those things, but I do think that violence, and I believe that Jesus would think a lot of violence and a lot of things that we see as toxic within marriages that are not the result of like little fights that you didn't have, or like I could find more flourishing elsewhere, which is a common divorce narrative today, but like actual destructive patterns, those are things that must be weighed through heavily in this, that, and the other. But at times it is necessary for that reason for these things to pull apart. So caveat, be aware. I do think that's important. I think Jesus thinks that important, and I really don't want anyone to leave thinking that hasn't been addressed. So there's that. If you have more questions about that, we can talk about that. But essentially, yeah, the rupture of this union is the only one. And the church in its wisdom is sort of, I think, gone through this on who gets to remarry and why. I think the most strong wisdom is the innocent party, which is the one who's been cheated on here, although they're rarely that innocent in some ways. They have withheld in other ways to the point in which the other person cheats. But the innocent party has often been given the right to remarry. And in the 21st century, the repentant guilty party has also been extended the right to remarry. And that's I think there's a lot of good and wise as God deals with us in our hard hearts on that. But we have to pray and we have to live into wisdom on that. That's a very hard part of that. And so the disciples, because this is such a weird response to that. If this is the situation between a husband and wife, it is better not to marry. I just think, what a bizarre, like, sometimes you sit with people who say what they're thinking on the inside out loud. And it seems like all the disciples had that sort of disposition of like, well, if you can't divorce for burnt toast, then better not to marry. But I think that it's more, they're being invited into considering what things meant in the design order of thing. And this is the different part of this is like, they're naming this right truth of like, if you think marriage is going to be easy, and it's just a walk in the park and this, that, and the other one, I think everybody here who's married would testify, not exactly. But two, that it is a hard-won truth to stay married, to be together. I was joking with Kelly. The immediate teaching before this is about forgiven 7 times 7 or 70 times 7. Like, what's one of the engines that makes marriage go? Forgiveness. So it's not like lost on me that this passage occurs within that nearness to that forgiveness teaching. No one can accept this word, but only those to whom has it been given, which raises the question of which he's referring to, the former or the latter word. For there were eunuchs born that way, and their eunuchs have been made eunuchs by others, and there's have chosen to live like eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven. The one who can accept this should accept it. Again, raises the question of accept the marriage as the hard part or the eunuch as the hard part. The eunuch one has been more taken in church history as a charism. That is a gift if people are called into that. But if you think about it as celibate just for a moment, I do think there's this interesting, there were celibates who were born that way, which in this context meant people who for some reason had an illness or inability to sort of be male or female or perform, you know, intimately in the world. And so they were born that way. There were eunuchs who had been made that way by others. There was in this world a terrible process of making somebody a eunuch. But I do think if you say those who have been made celibate by others, it's those whom want marriage and long for children, but because of the fact that they have not been able to find someone or that the world has aligned against them or because life is hard, they've been made celibate by others. I do think there's an opening there, and Christ's honoring of that to some degree is that these celibacy is a place here. And then the last one, which is those who become celibate for the kingdom of heaven, largely only the Catholic Church has kept that sort of vow alive. And I think we should be thankful that they have, and I do think that it's worth pondering if the Protestant Church can find a way to keep those who can accept the gift of celibacy, not as like this every time they come around, so when are you going to get married? Have you met anyone? This, that, and the other. But to say, you have a place, and we're not just going to see you as somebody's future partner, but as a person whole in and of themselves. And the church could learn from that quite a bit. And the people brought the little children to him, and he placed his hands on them and prayed for them. The disciples rebuked them. Jesus said, "Let the little children come to me, and do not hinder them, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to such as these." When he placed his hands on there, he went on from there. Again, we have marriage, we have this place for the celibate, and then we have the sexless single Savior blessing and having the time for children. In the Roman world, not the Jewish world, there were female sort of worship cults and male worship cults, and they didn't meet together. Christianity, through these teachings, becomes this family religion in some sense, a people religion. It has men and women in marriage. It has those who are made eunuchs, those who are celibate, those who are celibate for the sake of the kingdom. And then it has the fruits of these children who come not just to the parents, but to others to touch and to be blessed by them. And let the little children come to me. I just want to end with one illustration. I had the fortunate chance to go to a Taze worship service at a La Arche community in Portland. La Arche communities are made up of people mentally, most mentally or physically disabled to the point to which they would struggle to participate in the normal world in any sort of way. From the severe sort of unable to bathe, talk, this, that, and the other, to the ones that can sort of hold jobs and sort of be in the world fruitfully in some ways, but they live in the houses, that the mentally disabled, as the community members, is the way that La Arche narrates the service. And then the other people around them are sort of the workers. They don't get to be, the helpers are not the members. The members are the disabled. But anyways, sitting there in a Taze service, where Taze is just simply singing hymns and thinking about the little children, the least of these ones, and watching them worship, and watching in particular several of them. In a Taze service, it's somewhat often you'll have a crucifix that people are invited to come forward and touch. And to watch them touch, come forward and touch, and to kiss the cross, and to kneel there. The church is the place that has more time than we think to be with these people. We can build and make houses in which they are the center of those communities. And they're invited into worship with full dignity. And they're invited into making the decisions that make those place well. And so as I think about Jesus blessing children, which today we maybe think are cuter than the ancient Near East did, I think about that house and that place and saying, Jesus takes time to physically be with these people and bless them and touch them. As we disciples, pastors, whatever, would say, it's a busy man, let him move on. Christ is healing our souls in that way. Let us pray. God, you have blessed us with instructing us from our origin. It is not an easy word to hear, and we are unsure of what to do with all that in a world fractured by sin and destruction. But we hear and receive that word with the grace and the embrace of sinners that you meant it. And so too may we go forth knowing that we live in an age that wants to take